Hello and welcome. My name is Alan Nelson. I'm the founder and CEO of Accounting CPD. Thank you for joining us for this final Lunch and Learn session of 2023. I should start by welcoming all of you attending. I hope you find the next hour interesting, relevant, and useful. This month, I'm joined by three guests. First up is Julia Penny, who'll be talking about her year as president of ICAW. Then I'm welcoming Steve Collins, who'll be talking about the main updates we should be aware of in the last 12 months, and in particular, the FRC's periodic review. And finally, I'll be talking to Accounting CPD's Rachel Bruce, who'll be sharing some thoughts, some insights we've gleaned from you over the past month. As we go along, please do ask questions. The Q&A session at the end is often the most interesting part of the webinar, but it only works if you ask those questions. Along the way, you can also contribute by using the chat facility, and I'll try to pick those questions up as we go. So, without further ado, I'm delighted to welcome our first guest, Julia Penny. Julia is the immediate past president of ICAW, having been a non-executive ICAW board member since 2017 and chair of the board during her year as president. Julia is also a member of ICAW Council and a past chair of both the ICAW Technical Advisory and Ethics Advisory Committees, a former member of the Technical Strategy and Financial Reporting Faculty Boards and of the AAT's Council and Audit Committee. Outside of this volunteer ICAW involvement, Julia is also a well-known speaker and writer on audit, financial reporting, anti-money laundering, and wider issues impacting the profession. She's passionate about audit quality and a well-functioning profession. This includes a sharp focus on improving diversity, developing the use of technology, and constantly reflecting on the need for businesses to become sustainable and how the professionals can help achieve this. Hello, Julia.
Hello, Alan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you're very welcome. We're here to talk about your experiences over the last year, and it's a real privilege to be able to do this in this setting with a bit of time to spend on it. So perhaps actually, before we go into kind of what your personal experience was, perhaps I can ask you to start by telling us what people may think is obvious, but what is the role of being the president actually involved?
Well, it's interesting because it's actually changed between my year as president and now. So during my year as president, there were two key elements to it. And one, as you said, was chairing the board, the ICAW board, which works sort of pretty much like a corporate board. The other side of it was what I might broadly call the ambassadorial side, meeting members, prospective members, students, other stakeholders, and really getting the message out there and hearing the views in there as to what ICAW wanted to talk about and what members and others wanted to talk to us about. Now, that role has now changed because we've done a governance review. We're still in the process of some of the governance review at ICAW. And what we decided was that having a chair of the board for just 1 year, which is what you get with the president, because you're only president for 1 year, is a bit disruptive to change every year. So the tail end of my responsibility as president was chairing the panel that recruited a new chair of the board externally, a paid chair, who will have the role like a normal corporate chair of the board role, 3 year terms, renewable twice, so that you get a maximum of 9 years. So you get a continuity, at least 3 years, maybe up to 9 years of having that chair. So the current president will still have all of that ambassadorial role. Very, very important to do that listening, to do that talking to members and others that we want to engage with. But the chair of the board role now sits with Peter Wyman is our chair of the board.
Right, that sounds like a very sensible. It's an issue for all professional membership bodies, I think. The kind of not only that, but the tension between does the executive get too powerful, and do the members become, trying to get all that right is constantly difficult, I think. And I've seen organisations who seem to have it absolutely perfectly nailed, but they're relatively rare.
Yes, I think definitely rare.
So you talked about the ambassadorial role and about some of the things ICAW was trying to get across and some of the things you were listening to from members. To what extent were you able to make progress or make some gains in areas that you cared about?
Some progress. I mean, I think all of these things, they're a bit of a team effort and they take more than a single year, which is why we've made some of the governance changes. But I think a lot of the conversations I had, particularly with firms of accountants rather than those in business, firms were very much interested in the trust in the profession, the attractiveness of the profession, and the difficulties that firms were starting to see in people thinking audit, especially, was not looking so good. And it didn't matter which country I was in, there were very similar concerns that the regulators were getting over aggressive. And of course, you know, everybody gets a little bit vulnerable when you've got a regulator saying, you need to be better, you need to be better. But there is, in real life, there's a balance between how much you want the regulator to pound you on the head, and you still want to have an attractive profession. And of course, if the regulator goes overboard with the pounding on your head, metaphorically, obviously, then people say, well, you know, why would I want to audit? I just won't do it. And then you have another problem, which is there aren't enough auditors or there aren't good enough quality auditors, and the regulator still doesn't achieve what they're wanting to achieve. So I think there were lots of conversations with the regulators as well as with firms around trying to get that balance right and trying to get across that, you know, to the regulators that if you go too hard on something, actually, law of unintended consequences, you make audit very unattractive, then you don't actually have any auditors, or you don't have good auditors, or you don't have enough. And the other side, firms understanding that obviously you've got to get that quality, you've got to work as a firm. And we've got a new quality management standard, which I'm sure has been talked about over the past year, ISQM 1 and 2, but you know, 1 being the primary overall one, where firms are embedding that, starting to work with it, starting to try and get that quality approach based on risks. You know, what might go wrong with my quality? How do I mitigate that? And it's all part of that big ecosystem of regulators, firms, individual auditors. How do you bring it all together? So there were lots of conversations there. And I think, you know, started to, as you say, sort of move the dial, but still a lot of work to be done on that. So that was one area, which, yeah, lots going on in that area. There were others too, but I'll pause for a moment.
Well, you don't really know. I'm going to try and avoid talking to Steve about this later as well. We've just finished our audit and filed our accounts this week. And it was a painful process which involved me arguing with them a lot. And it's changed my opinion. But one thing that was really clear to me was that although I was moaning about the quality of the work that was going on, they were clearly suffering from a difficulty of retaining and hiring staff. And the, apart from the audit manager, the entire team who ran the audit were new from last year. So all the work we've done, you know, forget with them getting to know the business and understanding things, that was all lost. And I mean, you do still, obviously, you still have the audit files and you've got the information, but it's not the same as the same people.
It's not the same as what's in your head. We're not just computers. We're not just what we write down. You have to write it down, but as you say, it's not the same. And I think that that problem with staff has been a big problem, again, in lots of jurisdictions. I was lucky enough to go to, you know, lots of different places over my year as president. And virtually everybody, India being the exception, were saying that, you know, there aren't enough staff, there aren't enough accountants, but in particular, there aren't enough auditors. And we had a big merry-go-round, I think, after the pandemic, when people started thinking, oh, well, I don't know, is this what I want to do? And there was a big merry-go-round of staff moving on to other things. Interestingly, we've now, you know, the economic environment has changed. We've seen in the last sort of few months conversations with firms and in the newspapers, we've seen that redundancies are sort of on the cards. Probably not in audit, has to be said. But nonetheless, we're maybe going to get a shift, because if you start making redundancies in other bits, a lot of accountants might still have auditing skills. They might only have recently left audit. And they might think, well, actually, audit carries on when other bits of the business, like the management consultancy, sort of stop. So maybe we'll get a bit of a rebalancing. But I think, you know, it's a longer term thing. As students in particular come out of universities at the moment, they're thinking that they want, dare I say it, sexy tech sector jobs. You know, the bright young things are looking to different areas. And one of the important things that I was talking about in my year as president is actually accountancy gives you a huge opportunity. You can do sustainability assurance or reporting. You can specialize in, you know, making sure that financial markets work properly by being involved in audit, either internally or externally. You can help make sure businesses run properly. There's a lot of tech involved in accountancy now. So by going into accountancy, you're not saying, oh, I don't want to do tech. You're saying, I want to do tech in a particular area. You know, so getting across that, And the increasing, and there's a more work to be done on this, but you know, the increasing diversity, the inclusion part of the accountancy profession, this is really important. We're starting on the journey rather than finishing it. But I think those were conversations which were very important, continue to be very important, making sure that people understand how attractive the accountancy profession is. And I'm probably speaking to the converted, given that everybody here is probably an accountant. But you know, when you're talking to the next generation up, you know, there are lots of different opportunities coming in to accountancy. And of course, you can come in at a later point in your life as well. You don't have to come in straight from being a student. And that's always been the case. So I think, you know, those were really interesting, very important conversations that I was having as president with members, with firms, with those in business as well.
You mentioned along the way there the subject of diversity, which I know is something that you care about. I looked up how many ICAW presidents there've been. You can't actually look that up. You have to count. And I got, apart from a period, it doesn't really look like one every year, with except for the during the Second World War. But so that stretches back of maybe 150 years. You were only the fourth female president.
Yeah.
Do you think enough progress is being made in that area? Are we moving forward quickly enough?
I suppose my gut answer is no, and that's partly why I stood as you have to get elected as president. So council, which is a body of around about 100 people, elect you as vice president. You do a year as vice president, year of deputy president, year of president, as long as nothing goes horribly wrong along the way. And as you say, yeah, the fourth. We will have 150th anniversary in 2030. So the fourth in sort of 142 or 143, if you count the end of the year, depending where you're going. And you think, gosh, it's not really what we're looking for. On the plus side, three of those four have been since 2016. So, you know, it's much, much better than it was. I'm hoping that in another few years, we will have another female president in another few years, but we've got three men next on the roster. So, you know, it's better than it was. I think there's more work to be done, and there's more work to be done. From the governance point of view, there's a lot of work, you know, as part of governance review, looking at how you get the diversity inclusion, how you make sure that it's a place where women as well as men, but not just the gender diversity, you know, all other aspects of diversity as well, so ethnicity, disabilities, and so on and so forth. That it's a place which is comfortable for everybody, where everybody thinks, oh yeah, I can put my hand up, I could, you know, I could get voted for. It, you know, it's a journey. We're not there yet. We're not necessarily, and I think this probably applies to most accountancy bodies, we're not necessarily the quickest at changing things. We tend to be, as accountants, quite conservative in nature. So change is not necessarily rapid, but the more people stand up and say, I'm going to challenge the status quo, the quicker we get that change. And so that's, you know, one of the things that I've been talking a lot about over my year, or was talking a lot over my year as president.
Right. I think from sitting slightly outside of the profession but very close to it, it feels to me as though it's not rapid, but progress is definitely being made. And I'm sure there are some perspectives where it's being made more quickly than others. We've done
Always.
a fair bit of work in that area over the last few months. In fact, the webinar we're doing on Thursday focuses on inclusivity and diversity. So if anybody is interested, that's available. Should people want to see. Can I ask you? Feel free to say no to this. Not no, you can't ask me. I'm going to ask you. No, I didn't. But were there things that ICAW, I was curious about somebody who takes up this role. Are there things that the Institute wants you to talk about, or lines that they want you to put forward that you're less comfortable with or less enthusiastic about?
I mean, if you took it on a scale, there would probably be things that, yeah, I'm just less passionate about rather than less comfortable. So I don't think, I mean, to some extent, because I've been so heavily involved with the Institute for quite a lot of years, I'm quite closely aligned. You know, they've got a strategy. So they've got sort of three core pillars of the strategy, which is about members and students, which is about reputation, you know, which is about the regulatory side of it. So they're, yeah, there's nothing to be sort of upset about, if you like, or not want in those areas. And then we've got five strategic themes. And those strategic themes are, you know, strengthening trust, in ICAW Chartered Accountants and the profession more widely, particularly, you know, post-Carillion and whatever, that's really important. So that links in very closely with my audit quality work that I do in my sort of day job, if you like, and that I think is so important. So that's, you know, that's fine. I feel very closely identified with that. And the next one is achieving or helping to achieve the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. And obviously the sustainability part is a bit of that. You can't do everything. There's loads of SDGs, what is it, 17 or something goals. But there are a number, including some of the equality and the diversity points, which come into that, as well as the environment, which are very important. And transforming trade and economy, I can't talk very much about that. I think it's more about tax, it's more about how government works. But you know, there's nothing in it that I object to. And then we've got tech and data and mastering tech and data. And that's so important that accountants can do the tech and data, because otherwise somebody else will take our jobs entirely, if you like. And then you've got the attracting talent, building diversity, because that will strengthen the profession. So all of those strategic themes I was very on board with. There wasn't anything which I thought, no, you know, I don't want to say that because I've, you know, would never ethically say something that I didn't believe in. But nonetheless, would I push one bit more than another bit? Oh yes. And I definitely, you know, was pushing hard on the diversity side, and trying to push hard on the sustainability side and the importance of accountants taking a proactive role in that.
That's all. I mean, admirable, I think, and I completely agree. But actually, interestingly, you were there at a time with the, particularly the audit profession under you know, barrage of criticism, where the obvious lines the institute would take are things that, as an accountant, you feel strongly about, because if the reputation of the profession suffers, then that has a negative impact on everybody who practices.
It does, and I think that, you know, that piece for me, the, you know, the bits I don't agree with everything that everybody says in the institute or anywhere else, because, you know, life would be very boring. And if any of your readers have read some of the articles that I publish every now and then on various places, they, you know, I don't always take the, oh yeah, everything's fine, isn't it? But it's normally about pushing a particular area and challenging a particular area more. And I think that sort of trust in the profession, we as accountants, we as ICAW, we as ACCA, you know, whatever professional body you're a part of, you know, you have to look at, does my institute, does my association, does it need to be doing more to help, you know, build trust in the profession? Because my job depends on people trusting me as a trusted professional. So, you know, is enough happening? And I think there was a lot of, you know, soul searching going on, and, you know, things like changes to CPD requirements, which all of the ICAW members, I hope at least, will have heard, because they're, you know, they're really major. But, you know, to a large extent, those are a response to when the outside world looks at us as auditors in particular, but as accountants, as directors in companies, as people advising on finance. Can they be sure that they've got somebody who's fully trained, who's up to date, who's, you know, at the top of their game? And some of that CPD, you know, requirement is therefore to make sure that the outside world can have more trust in that area. So I think, you know, some things get pushed more than others from, you know, my point of view in terms of where I'm interested.
Yeah, I think the outside perspective, the sort of the person in the street type perspective on accountants, is unfortunately lacking in terms of how professional and how ethical accountants are. I mean, I don't want to sound po-faced about it, but there's a big emphasis on ethics. And when I talk to accountants, they really do live and breathe that stuff, most of them. But of course, you only need a couple of really bad stories where people behave badly, and the whole profession gets tarred.
Yeah, you only need a couple. And also the other thing, and this is very interesting, and it links into that ISQM one sort of auditing standard, but it applies really more broadly, which is ISQM one takes what is called a sort of risk approach to quality, and it's management of that risk. And it's saying, okay, well, what might impact on the quality of whatever work I do as an accountant, for instance. And what you've got in that is a way to really reflect on the system as a whole. So if I'm working in a firm, what is it that makes a particular accountant in a firm, you know, some of the things that we've heard coming out of Carillion, for instance, what is it that makes a particular individual think, oh, it doesn't matter if I don't do this, or I do it wrong, or I do this instead. Why is that individual in a position that they feel either able to do that, encouraged to do that, empowered, forced into a corner? So it's all part of the bigger system. And if you get a really good quality management approach, which some other industries have, more experienced, if you like, at taking that particular approach, they're looking all of the time at what pressures are put on the individual. And is it the pressures on the individual that cause them to behave poorly? Or is it that the individual is just a bad apple and they just don't care, or they're just not educated enough, or, so it's that wider issue. And I think that's a fascinating part of the whole quality. And it's not just audit, even though the standard is only audit and assurance related. It's, for all of us, how we do our work, what risks us doing something wrong. And often, it's pressures.
It's interesting, isn't it, that a lot of the work you do on an audit is to make sure the right controls are in place, the right checks and balances. And a lot of those are designed to not only to deter somebody from doing something, encourage them to behave well, but also to put a second person on certain things so that two people would have to collude and do something badly rather than just one. And so it's actually a bit of a physician heel theyself in terms of some of the checks and balances that need to go in place in that audit management, quality management thing.
Absolutely.
Mark Rees has now taken over from you, and Malcolm Backus is waiting in the wings to take over from him. What advice would you give them?
Gosh, what advice would I give? Well, if I'm honest, I gave Mark my to-do list, which the things that I hadn't
Here's the
quite
stuff
finished.
I didn't get
Don't tell
to.
anybody else. So yeah, because you're only there for a year, there were things that I'd still like these things to be done. So I did give them a little, a medium to-do list. But I think the advice is that A, you've got to throw yourself into it, which both of those absolutely will throw themselves into it. B, all of it is about relationships, about talking to people, it's about hearing those views, it's about feeding those back and continuing to sort of develop, what the ICAEW is doing to make sure that we're dealing with concerns where concerns arise, to make sure that we're driving things externally, for instance, with regulators, with others. And of course, it'll be a bit different for Mark because he chaired for a short while because we didn't have Peter Wyman in place quite straight away. But then he's doing the ambassadorial stuff. He's sitting on the board still, so it's re still really important that he's got that voice of being able to say, okay, look, members are saying, or others that I'm talking to are saying. But I think it's about throwing themselves into it, it's about listening hard, and it's about making sure that they, also push where there are things that, no, this needs doing, this needs doing, this needs doing, that, they are tenacious. And they push things forward. And I know both of them very well, and they are both extremely tenacious. So I'm very confident that we've left it all in good hands.
That's great. I think if I can get that listening piece right, that's really important. I really sympathize with the fact that every time you're sent to an event, you're expected to make a speech. And so you're not in listening mode automatically. You must have to make yourself do that.
So, you're very concentrated, you prepare, you've got your speech, you're like, okay, I'm going to talk about this. But then, as you say, you need to listen back. And the listening is usually in the less formal things. So I have to say, I mean, I was lucky enough to have quite a lot of breakfasts, lunches, dinners, drinks, receptions, and goodness what. And those are opportunities to listen and then make sure that you feed back those points so that they don't get lost. Because ultimately, it is a professional body. Professional body is made up of members and prospective members, coming in. We've got to make sure that we understand what they think. And that's one of the key roles that the president has, to meet tons of members and to say, okay, right, this is what I'm hearing.
There must be things that they'd be prepared to say to you that they wouldn't quite say to just a member of the executive team.
I think so, because you're talking to them member to member, even though lots of the executive team are also members, almost all of them actually. But it's different, isn't it? The dynamic is different. So they will, dare I say, they'll moan at you, they'll moan with you, they'll express, oh, I want this to happen, I want that to happen. And some of it is realistic and some of it isn't realistic. And sometimes you can't just promise and say, oh yeah, all of that will be done, because what one person wants might be diametrically opposed to what somebody else wants. So some people will tell you, oh, sustainability, that's a load of rubbish, it's world's gone mad. And you're like, well, that's all very well, but what about, your assets for the company that you work in, you run? They might change in value because actually, there's a flood, there's a forest fire, there's all sorts of other things that, we've started to see some of the climate change impacts mucking up the weather. And it does have, direct physical impacts on assets. But then you've got the non-physical ones where people stop buying, I don't know, like they stop buying individual single-use bottles of water because, oh, well, actually, that's not a very good idea, is it? I'll bring my own bottle, I'll refill it. If you were the company producing bottles, you've got to have found something else to do. Otherwise, you've gone bust or you're about to.
Yeah, lots of frictional difficulties for organisations like that. I have one more question for you before you go. We need to be brief, but the question is, what are you going to do with all the time you've got there?
It seems to get swallowed up quite quickly. I went freelance a couple of years before, so in 2020, pandemic, not really a very helpful start to going freelance. And so now I'm basically trying to build up my work again, but I'm also looking, I think, for a non-executive directorship. Having sat on the board since 2017, as you said, sat on a nominating committee, recruited and a new chair of the board, Remco, audit committee experience in various places, I sort of think, oh yes, I think I'm missing that a little bit. So looking for that, but all the technical and training. So I'm writing slides on ISA 600 at the moment for something else. And so it's getting that work up and going again. And a little bit of golf in there as well.
Good for you. Glad to hear it. Okay, so I'm going to have to bring that section of the webinar to a close, or we'll run out of time. So for now, I'll say thank you very much, Julia. We'll see you in a few minutes, and we welcome you back to answer questions from people. But for now, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I'll hang around.
So without further ado, I should introduce our next guest, Steve Collins. Steve is the audit and technical partner at Levitt Walmsley Associates. He's a prolific writer and commentator on all aspects of financial reporting and audit, and the author of over 20 books on the subject. A good friend of Accounting CPD, Steve is a frequent guest at these webinars, author of CPD Bites and News Bites, and of several of our courses, including, of course, our annual updates on UKAN Ireland GAAP and on auditing. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Alan.
So we're here today to look at the year of 2023. You were with us a couple of months ago and we focused on auditing updates. And so today I thought perhaps we should focus on financial reporting. The big event of the year was the FRC's periodic review. What are the main changes there that people should be aware of?
Well, I mean, the periodic review, it's sort of still ongoing at the moment. The FRC are sort of busy beavering away, I think, behind the scenes, finalising the amendments to the periodic review. There are some headline proposals on the cards from the FRC, and what I can sort of say is having quite a lot of conversations with the FRC in various different roles that I have with professional bodies and in other sort of arenas. I am lucky to get sort of updates on a periodic basis from them. And the last update that we got, they have confirmed that the effective date of the amendments has been pushed back further, which I sort of expected to happen, because the standard setting process is quite a very long-winded process, even to make sort of a small change to an accounting standard or a section of the accounting standard involves an awful lot of work behind the scenes by the FRC in looking at the change, looking at sort of any fatal flaws, going through various committees, all the way through to being approved by the FRC board. So you can imagine that on a periodic review with an exposure draft that's about 340 odd pages long, that there's an awful lot of work needs doing behind the scenes. So the FRC have sort of confirmed that the periodic review amendments will become effective for accounting periods commencing on after the 1st of January 2026. We are expecting early adoption to be permissible. I'm also expecting the FRC to say that if you want to early adopt an amendment, you will need to early adopt all the amendments at the same time. Now, a lot of people who I've certainly been speaking to in courses over the last few months have sort of said, well, that's ages off, isn't it? 1st of January 2026. But when you consider the impacts of some of the amendments that are proposed, and they are quite significant in terms of the not only the accounting treatment, but also the impact that the changes could have on businesses. And I think the headline changes, of course, on balance sheet lease accounting. And this is very likely to go ahead. I mean, if I was a betting man, which I'm not, but if I was, I would put money on this finding its way into FRS 102. And the FRC have said that this is very much the direction of travel that they're going in with on-balance sheet lease accounting. Now, this it's important just to understand that there are sort of two mainstream standards in the UK and Republic of Ireland. So you've got FRS 102, which I would say is the most common. Everybody's heard of FRS 102, I would hope, anyway, if you're preparing financial statements. And then you've got FRS 105, which is the micro entity standard. The on-balance sheet, lease accounting rules won't find their way into FRS 105. So FRS 105 is being left alone where that's concerned. But essentially, pretty much every sort of lease will find its way on the balance sheet. And a lot of accountants get sort of confused by what is going on here, because, you know, a lot of questions that I get asked involve the one, well, why will one asset be on two balance sheets? It's going to be on the lessor's balance sheet and the lessee's balance sheet. And technically, that's not quite right, because the lessee isn't capitalising the asset as such. They're capitalising their right to use that asset. And that's sort of the approach that Section 20 will be taking. So we are going to sort of see a lot of change where on-balance sheet lease accounting is concerned. Those changes will, of course, be reflected in the Nelson, the accounting CPD course that I write for the UK GAAP update to make sure that, you know, delegates are aware of the changes. I think the important aspect for accountants where that is concerned is to A, not only understand the technical changes. I mean, the reality of it is most accountants know how to account for a finance lease. And basically that's what we'll be doing most of, is accounting for finance lease, even though you won't have a distinction between a finance and an operating lease anymore. But also, I think the important thing is for businesses to be looking at things like any potential loan covenants that they've got in place, because, of course, the on-balance sheet lease approach will mean that you're going to be bringing on additional assets and liabilities onto the balance sheet. There's a risk that existing debt covenants could get breached. Now, some financiers might take the view that, well, if it's a breach of a debt covenant because of a change in regulation, so, for example, the FRC have made a change to an accounting standard and therefore the client can't help it, they've got to do it, then some financiers may be more willing to negotiate debt covenants or even sort of say, well, that's outside the scope of a breach, if you like. But it is always worth looking at agreements and sort of determining whether there are any breaches that could happen, because getting prepared right from the outset of all of this is one of the reasons really why the FRC are giving such a long implementation period, so that there's a lot of people that can get prepared for this, including software providers as well. So I think on balance sheet lease accounting, that is one of the key points to be aware of. The other sort of headline change, which I don't feel, it's not that I don't feel strongly, I'm sort of less concerned about the revenue recognition changes than I am the lease accounting changes. And revenue recognition, we're having brand new Section 23 in FRS 102 and brand new Section 18 in FRS 105. And essentially, to sum the change up, what the FRC are doing is aligning the revenue recognition rules to that of IFRS 15, although it's wrong to say it's going to be IFRS 15, because you can't have IFRS in full in FRS 102, because that would be completely disproportionate. I'm less concerned about that because, I mean, we already have a sort of step model approach in section 23, for example. So we've got like five criteria that have to be met before we recognise a sale of goods. And we've got four criteria that are met to determine the reliability of the outcome of a contract sort of thing. So we're already used to this going through various stages to make sure that something's happened before we recognize a sale. So the five-step model approach, I think, is going to be, it will sort of change some revenue practices, but I would be amazed, I've said this quite publicly, I'd be amazed if we are going to see wholesale restatements of revenue and ways of changes in accounting policies. I think what it will do is force companies to review their revenue accounting policy, not only just to make sure that they are doing things in accordance with their declared policies, but also making sure that perhaps the disclosure note in the accounting policy section of the accounts is up to date, is appropriate, and is, of course, entity specific. So there's quite a few changes on the cards where the periodic review is concerned. And I know the 1st of January 2026 may seem quite a long way off, but I was talking to my co-director this week and we were amazed just how quickly 5 years has gone past. You know, it just the years just seem to get, they just zoom past quicker and quicker.
You're getting older, Stephen.
This is it. Well, yeah, I'm trying to avoid saying, well, yeah, I am in the final year of my 40s now. So it's sort of like, you know, it's true what your grandparents say. When as you get older, it goes quicker. No. So I think that's where we are with the periodic review. So the FRC have sort of said that they will be issuing the final amendments in the first half of 2024. That, of course, takes us up to the end of June. But, I would imagine that the FRC will get them out before those sorts of dates. But as I say, there's a huge process that goes on behind the scenes. I was involved in the standard setting process for about 5 years, a couple of years ago. So there's a huge process that goes on behind the scenes. So it isn't easy for them to just, you know, update the documents and send all the publications out. But I think the key points to be aware of, if you are involved in preparation of UK and Ireland GAAP financial statements, is just to keep an eye out on developments and keep clients informed sooner rather than later, because there are a number of clients that are going to be significantly affected by this. I've got a client at the moment that's in the haulage industry, and they've got about 75 operating leases that are all going to have to go on the balance sheet under the new rules. And we've already started doing the impact assessment on all of this as well. So it is something that we do need to keep an awareness of.
One of the things that I know has been highlighted by people, as with both the leases and the revenue recognition, as things that seem to be, have been introduced into IFRS, coming down to IFRS 102. Not sure coming down is the right phrase, actually. That suggests that one's superior to the other, doesn't it? That there's an issue of kind of the burden on really on the smaller businesses of doing some of these things. And certainly, without going into lots of detail, the debates I was having with the auditors were about revenue recognition. We make about 50,000 sales a year each time someone buys a combination of different products with different access periods. And if you take a very, very a purist line to the way that revenue is spread out, you could end up with more people counting up the money than actually going into providing the service. And so there was a whole ongoing long debate about what was reasonable and how close we had to get to the, you know, absolute letter of the law. Are there other ways in which the changes that have been proposed in the periodic review might have a disproportionate impact on the SME?
Yeah, that you've made a very, very valid point there, because I think one of the issues that's come out of the exposure, there was a 4-month comment period for FRED 82, which was the exposure draft of the changes that the FRC are proposing, which is slightly longer than standard. Usually an exposure draft is about 3 months, but given the nature of these changes, the FRC deemed it necessary to have that have a little bit longer. And interestingly, some of the comments they received, I think about 54 comment letters, the FRC on Fred 82, which I thought was quite a low response rate, really, for something that contains some pretty significant changes. But some commentators have suggested that the revenue recognition rules that they are proposing are too onerous for micro entities, and FRS 105 should be left as it is for micro entities. And this has sort of left the team involved in dealing with the periodic review scratching their heads to a certain extent as to what they can do to try and alleviate those concerns. Because obviously micro entities need a very, very straightforward and simple accounting standard to reflect the complexity and the nature of their businesses. So there's sort of, there are some concerns already been raised about things like that. The on-balance sheet lease accounting issue, that is also, that's also been sort of mixed in terms of the responses. And what I've found, particularly in courses over the last 6 months, is that it's a very divisive subject, this on-balance sheet lease accounting. You've got those that are completely against it, and you've got those that are completely for it, and there's nobody sat on the fence in the middle. And there are some sort of comments that have been sent into the FRC about what they're proposing. And even though it is very likely that we are going to be doing on balance sheet lease accounting, the FRC are looking at clarifying what they're proposing to do. So, for example, I've got a bit of an issue with the FRC's proposal to about the low value asset thing. So if you've got a lease of an asset that's of low value, you can pretty much treat it the same way that you would treat a current operating lease. And I think there's a danger of this being misinterpreted. So I've said to the FRC, why don't you just quantify something? Now, if you look at IFRS 16 in the basis for conclusions, the IASB, rightly or wrongly, did have put in their sort of basis for conclusions that they had an amount of $5,000 in mind when they were developing IFRS 16. So it's important to emphasize this, that figure is not in the standard, it's in the basis for conclusions. And I've asked the FRC if they would consider quantifying it, and basically it's a no, it's going to be a no. But what they are going to do is they are going to look at making it clearer as to what things like low value means in the standard, and perhaps looking at FRS 105 to sort of come up with a solution that's proportionate to micro entities. And this is where the FRC need comments and feedback on exposure drafts, because if they don't know, the FRC aren't going to be able to do anything about it. So if the likes of myself and Julia go to do a lecture and we are explaining what the technical changes are, and delegates aren't happy and they say, well, we don't agree with it, we think it should be this or we think it should be that, and my immediate question to them then is, well, did you write in to the FRC and explain that when you had the opportunity? And the answer is usually no. And this is why I always sort of say, whenever you've got something in an exposure draft that you do feel quite strongly about, then it is always worth submitting a response to the FRC.
I think that's a really good point. I've come across this before, that on the few occasions when I've actually got to talk to people who are involved in the standard setting process, they're really hungry for that kind of feedback. And I think it's a shame that people often think, well, that process is probably going to be handled by the professional body or by the Big Four. They're not really interested in what I have to say. And they are. They really are interested in what you have to say.
I can tell you from being involved in sort of the technical advisory group at the FRC that they are very keen to hear from smaller practitioners and companies who are dealing with it. I mean, you know, the Big Four, the top 20 firms, those sorts of people, you know, they're obviously great at what they do. But a lot of the time, they might not deal with micro entities and FRS 105. So the FRC are really looking for comments to be received from those that are dealing with the standard on a daily basis. And, you know, you might be a sole practitioner or in a two-partner firm, and you might send a response in about something that you don't agree with. And there could have been a flurry of the same responses, and the FRC will then do something about it, or they will try to come up with a solution.
Good. Well, I think that's a that we've got to move us on because we're going to run out of time. But actually, that's a really nice place to leave things on, to encourage people that, that your voice is they're interested in listening to it, and people should become involved. So I'll say thank you, Steve, for now. As always, fascinating, and thank you for summarizing all that so neatly. Stick around, come back at the end. Yep, I'm sure people will have questions. Oh, actually, I have got one question here, Steve, that someone has posted. I should have noticed it earlier. It's about lease accounting. If we're capitalizing the right to use an asset, should the asset be split between current and non-current, reflecting the consumption of the right to use the asset?
Well, if you've got a current asset, so a lease of an asset of a short, well, short-term asset, this is, so anything current is 12 months or less, you could just write that off over the lease term in much the same way that we do an operating lease, now, because there is going to be an exception to on-balance sheet lease accounting for short-term leases, which are leases that have got 12 months or less to run from the start of the lease, that is, not at the balance sheet date. So that's important to emphasise that. Anything else, you would be capitalising.
Okay.
Unless it's a low-value asset as well.
Okay, yeah, you're fair enough. All right, well, thank you very much, and we'll see you again at the end.
Yep.
Great. So now I'm delighted to welcome Accounting CPD's Rachel Bruce, who's going to share some of the things we've learned from you this month. Rachel's our publisher. She handles all of our relationships with authors and subject matter experts. I think I've shared this in one webinar before. I hope it wasn't those of you listening today who heard this, but Rachel recently celebrated her 23rd anniversary at Nelson Crew, the publisher of Accounting CPD. So she
Thanks,
really does know. Yeah, that's not very kind, is it? She really does know a thing or two about how things work around here. But hello, Rachel.
Hello, Alan. Thank you for listening to me again today.
Good. We recently had an autumn statement in November, although I think a lot of us have now forgotten that ever happened. But we did. So what's been the reaction from our users?
Yeah, so obviously at Accounting CPD, we released a fair bit of content on that. So the day after the statement, we actually published some content from Steve in his analysis using a news bite. And so we were just thinking, what does the autumn statement mean for accountants? And it looks like, you know, we're thinking that 2024 will be a more settled year with inflation falling, some big changes in national insurance with contributions falling, obviously, to 10% for the majority of people. Generally, this statement went as expected, I think, was what everybody said. But we asked our learners, you know, what are the standout measures for you or your business and why? And these are some of the comments that we had. So somebody said, not many standout measures, to be honest. An increase in minimum wage should hopefully help for some people. So this was a really common comment, and lots of people were unsurprised about this. There were some other comments, like, for example, the public sector were hoping for announcements on social care funding, but there was nothing that will help. So I think that was relevant to a few of our users for sure. And then one of the general vibes was about the decrease in national insurance contributions and people saying this is going to be the only thing that will directly impact me. So I think, you know, we did have some comments, but there was not, as you're saying, it kind of went as expected.
I think there was a discussion that I read about how they were to some extent holding fire and waiting for the spring, perhaps
yes.
prior to an election.
Yeah,
we'll see what happens then. You mentioned national insurance. We published a bite on that, didn't we? What did that cover?
Yes, yeah, so obviously there were some changes to national insurance, so we thought they merited their own bite. So we did publish a bite with this with one of our subject matter experts, Andy Rain, for being involved in that. And he provided a little history of the recent changes to national insurance. So he said in the bite, in April 2022, Class 1 rates went up by 1.25% to 13.25% on earnings between 9,880 and 50,270, and a 3.25% increase on earnings or over £50,270. And he goes on to kind of make some discussions about that. So it's worth going and having a look at that and seeing, you know, and just giving yourself a bit of a background about that if you need to just remind yourself of the numbers and the figures. He said in terms of Class 2 national insurance, it's being scrapped for the self-employed, but that it's still possible to pay on a voluntary basis to accrue a qualifying year. So it's worth remembering that. So during this bite, which is worth going and have a look at, we asked our license holders who will benefit most from the national insurance changes that are announced and why. And the general consensus was people would say it looks as though the changes will mostly benefit the employed and self-employed. And there's a small change, but every little does help. So small but good. And a couple of comments, like we had this one: I think the employer's burden should have been lowered also, as a lot of small businesses in, for example, hospitality, are already struggling with higher raw material costs. They will really feel the effect of the increase on national minimum wage. So this user would have really liked some help for smaller businesses, I think, particularly the ones that are needing to raise wages in line with the minimum. So yeah, some interesting comments and feedback, and it was a very well used bite. So worth going and have a look at if you haven't done so already.
Right. So finally, the domestic reverse charge for VAT. I think you've been looking at that.
Yes, we have. And that was also Andy Rainford again as well, who was talking about the domestic reverse charge for VAT. And so before we started the bite and talking about this, we asked users how much they knew about reverse charging. And more than half of our users said that they'd heard of it, but weren't sure what it was for. So we thought it was worth a bit of a recap. So Andy wrote about how builders no longer charge VAT on their affected invoices, and instead their customer will make a reverse charge entry on their own VAT return as output tax with a corresponding input tax claim. And this, of course, only works if both parties are VAT registered. So at the end of the bite, which again, if it's relevant to you, worth going and having a look at, we asked, what advice would you give to construction businesses to make sure they're getting this right? And we had lots of users that come back and said that, you know, it's really worth checking the four questions to see what applies. And we talk about these in the bite. And so the four questions are, is their customer VAT registered? Is their customer registered for the construction industry scheme? Does the work in question fall within the scope of the construction industry scheme? And is the customer an end user or intermediary supplier for any of the work? So a lot of users were finding this particular checklist really, really useful. And I think a lot of the comments are what we see time and time again on accounting CPD bites and in our courses as well, is keep very clear records, communicate very clearly with your suppliers. And I think obviously, again, that can be applied to all sorts of areas that we're talking about in accounting. And obviously, Julia was talking about this earlier as well, about, you know, just talking to people and listening to people and how important that is in this industry. So that was that bite.
Keep very clear records. We were talking about that with Julia and Steve before we came live on the webinar about CPD records as well.
Yes.
So yeah, that goes right across. That comes across activity. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Rachel. That's brilliant. But stay where you are while I welcome back Julia and Steve so that we can share some of the questions that have come in. I'm going to ask Steve the first question. If you were president of ICAW, what would you change?
I'm not
sure they'd let you be. You're ACCA, aren't you? So there's no way they'd let you be.
Well, that's not what I could change, because I'm not an ICAW member.
Let's ignore that for the moment.
You can become one.
I don't think I can really answer that, to be honest, because it's not something that I've got any experience in, being a president of anything, in fairness.
That's fine. I'm being facetious, of course. Julia, I was talking to Steve about the impact of regulation on smaller entities. To what extent do you think regulatory bodies get the balance right between sort of large public interest entities and smaller organisations when they're thinking through policy?
I don't think they get it right. You asked to what extent. I think, let's be mean and take the FRC, because they are one of the key regulators that we're concerned with from a audit and accounts point of view. And, you know, their primary remit is, if you like, the capital markets, so the listed companies. And so there's a lot of effort, a lot of concentration there. They do take steps like having, you know, people like Steve on committees and groups that advise. But quite often what we hear from the SME sort of end of the market, and what we see as, you know, technical experts and lecturers looking at it, is that they haven't really quite understood, and they don't build things from the bottom up. So if you built an auditing standard, and this goes right internationally because it's IAASB, you know, that are writing auditing standards, if you properly built them from the bottom up for a small entity, they would be properly principle based. They would work for a tiny weeny audit or a massive great audit. And there's not enough of an understanding of that, and they're not built from the bottom up. And the same applies to a lot of the accounting standards, although FRS2, at least because it's designed more for the SME market, you know, does hit that sweet spot much, much better.
I know this is a hobby horse of yours, Steve, that simplicity in accounting standards. Maybe we'd be better off in terms of keeping the standards simpler if we started by writing a standard for a smaller entity and then complicating it for more complex situations rather than
I've been saying that for years, you know, and Julia is completely on the same page as me with this, in that, you know, you, writing standards big down rather than down up is the wrong direction. And this, to me, is the reason why audit quality is where it is, because people just don't understand what the standard is actually requiring from them.
Rachel, I have a question for you. We've been reviewing the year today. If you had to pick out one thing that's created a buzz or, I don't know, interest or controversy or whatever it might be amongst our users, what would it be?
Oh, that's really hard to pick one thing. I think when we're looking at our flagship courses, we've published quite a few courses in the last kind of quarter of the year. There's three in particular, I think. We've published one on AI for accountants, and we were really interested to see what accountants are thinking about that. And the course kind of helps you to kind of understand how to use AI efficiently and like look at how you're going to increase productivity and as a result of it. And actually, everyone's been really, really positive about it. And I thought there would be some pushback, but there really hasn't. And people are saying it's a real eye opener for what the future holds and great information and education for everybody. And the content has made me think about my own skills development. So lots of really interesting kind of feedback about that already. And we also published a course called The Year in Accountancy as well, which really kind of goes back across the whole of 2023 and reviews the key headlines and developments and the trends of the past year to really help you understand the implications for the profession. So that was just a, you know, something that we haven't ever done before, accounting CPD, but it has worked really well. And people seem to be really enjoying it and really having a look at that really good review of the whole year. So those two things. And finally, I think our new course on dilemmas and threats, ethical dilemmas and threats, and really looking at that and those grey areas of ethics and how to deal with them and how to approach them. So, sorry, that's not one thing, that's three, but those are my three highlights, I think, that I'd like to pick out.
Good, thank you very much. So I guess with that, I should wrap this up, or we're going to overrun our time out. Stay our welcome. Don't forget, we have automatic logging. So if you're watching this live, your CPD will be logged by the system. Normally, that accounts for pretty much everybody watching, because accounting CPD webinars are a service exclusive to license holders. Today, though, we have some people trying out our webinars for the first time. If you're one of those people and are interested in signing up for accounting CPD for 2024, just head over to the website to find out more or message us. Whether or not you decide to take up a license, you can record your attendance at today's webinar as an hour of verifiable CPD on the site, and it'll appear on your CPD log. Just remains for me to say thank you to our panelists. Thank you, Julia, for sharing us your observations of your year as queen of everything.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve, for talking us through the periodic review. And thank you, Rachel, for sharing what we've learned from the accounting CPD community this month. Most importantly, thank you all for coming. Our next Lunch and Learn webinar is at 1 p.m. on the 24th of January, when we'll be welcoming back Steve, who'll be focusing on audit. Before that, we'll be back live this Thursday at 11 o'clock when we welcome Mo Kanjalel, who'll be talking about equality and inclusion. For those of you who won't be able to make that, I hope you're able to relax and enjoy the festive period. Everyone here at Accounting CPD wishes you a happy and a prosperous new year. Till then, goodbye.